You're listening to the Spark Radio Network, internet radio like you've never heard before. Innovation, creativity, and imagination are all said to begin with a spark. So fasten your seatbelt and take the ride of your life and listen for the spark.
You are listening to KLRN Radio, where liberty and reason still reign.
Most writers and radio show hosts know that to connect with your fans, you need to do more than just write books or record the latest podcasts. There are many different elements that go into forming an online platform, but there are also many hidden traps. To make matters worse, solid advice on how to survive the muddy waters is scarce. In the book Hidden Traps, I talk about some of the important issues of working with an online platform, highlighting traps that could put your physical or internet security at risk or be harmful to your reputation. Are your social media posts just links with a few disjointed words making you look like someone who can't complete a sentence? Did your new website cost you more than you anticipated? Are you leaking your personal contact details across the web without even knowing it? Then you need Hidden Traps. Hidden Traps is now available in paperback and ebook from a variety of retailers, including Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and Kobo. Visit blackwolfpublications.com for more details.
If you're 85 or younger, would you like peace of mind and comfort for your family? We're Final Expense Direct with an urgent message for you. The average funeral today costs over $8,000, but the most you'll get from government benefits is $255. How will your family pay the difference? We can help. Our senior plans start as low as just a dollar a day and pay up to $30,000 for a funeral and other final expenses. Peace of mind is easy. There's no medical exam. You'll have lifetime coverage, and your plan can't be canceled as long as you pay your premiums. Call now for free information about our senior plans. Answer a few simple questions and receive approval right on the phone. Plus, call right now, and we'll give you a discount prescription card for free. Call 800-553-8687. That's 800-553-8687. Again, 800-553-8687.
KLRN Radio has advertising rates available. We have rates to fit almost any budget. Contact us at advertising@klrnradio.com.
Everyone loves liberty. Our rights come from God, not the government. So why are you letting other people tell you what's best for your health care? Exercise your freedom with Liberty HealthShare. Liberty HealthShare is a community of people who voluntarily share one another's medical costs. Liberty HealthShare is founded on the idea that most people truly want to help one another. Healthcare sharing allows members to do just that as a true community that supports one another in times of need. Liberty believes people should make decisions for themselves and their families. Members are able to take back the freedom to make their own decisions about their health care. Freedom from guilt or doubt about how your money is used. You have the freedom to direct your health care, not to be dictated to by bureaucrats. Stop letting others tell you what to do and join a community of like-minded people. Exercise your freedom. Join Liberty HealthShare and take back the control of your health care while helping those around you. Call Liberty at 855-58-LIBERTY. Again, that's 855-58-LIBERTY for more information, or you can check them out at libertyhealthshare.org. Again, that's libertyhealthshare.org.
Here's George Foreman with InventHelp.
Hi, I'm George Foreman. Do you have an idea for a new product or invention? People ask me all the time, George, how do I get my idea in front of companies? How do I get a patent? What do I do next? Do you have the same questions? I'll tell you like I'll tell them all. Call my friends at InventHelp.
Call InventHelp today for free information. InventHelp has been helping inventors for more than 30 years and has sales offices nationwide. InventHelp can submit your invention to companies who are interested in receiving new ideas. If you have an idea and want to try to patent it and submit it to companies, you should call InventHelp today for free information.
Listen, I can't guarantee a company will be interested in your idea, but I believe every inventor deserves the opportunity to step into the ring and take their best shot. Put InventHelp in your corner.
Get your free inventor's information. Call 1-800-353-6490. That's 1-800-353-6490. Again, 1-800-353-6490.
At St. Jude, a family never sees a bill at all. It's like the world has been lifted off of your shoulders.
St. Jude Children's Research Hospital, finding cures, saving children. Learn more at stjude.org.
Sometimes riders feel lost, unsure why a passage may not be working. It takes another set of eyes to help us nurture our riding into full maturity. At Black Wolf Editorial Services, we strive to enable riders to develop and grow, offering manuscript critiques and line edits through a mentoring editorial style. We also offer assistance on generating a writer's bio for your websites. Black Wolf Editorial Services, nurturing your writing into maturity. For a full list of services, visit blackwolfeditorial.com.
Sometimes we need to slow down and remember the simple pleasures in life. Good coffee, good books, and good company. Come on in. Take a seat. The coffee's just been brewed. Let's see who we have in the coffee shop today.
Wow, what a wonderful day in the coffee shop. And as I'm looking around, Robin Weiss, is that the Dragon Slayer's son?
It is.
And it's got your name on it. Awesome. Another book. Amazing. I love books. So tell me a little bit about the Dragon Slayer's son.
Well, the Dragon Slayer's son is my second novel, and it is about a boy whose father is killed in the line of duty as a dragon slayer. And so his son Nathan is swept away to the Alexander School for Heroic Arts, where he is to train as his father's successor. Unfortunately, when he gets there, he realizes that dragons aren't really what he thought they were, and in fact, his father might not actually be dead. And so he and his friends need to go rescue his father. And to do that, they actually have to go and enlist the help of the dragons and unravel a international ring of wildlife smugglers as well along the way.
Wow, that sounds fascinating. Now, this is a fantasy or a high fantasy?
It is a fantasy. It's set in New Zealand, set in modern day New Zealand with dragons.
And you live in New Zealand?
I do.
And correct me if I'm wrong, wasn't The Hobbit filmed in New Zealand?
The Hobbit and the Lord of the Rings movies, yes, they were all filmed here.
So I guess, did that play any role in your inspiration for setting your dragon-filled fantasy in New Zealand?
It probably did, but if you've ever been to New Zealand and hiked around in our mountains, it's a place that inspires sort of what-if thinking, because there's a lot of wilderness here. There's a lot of, we have a lot of real creatures here that sort of have taken on mythical proportions. And so it is a landscape that inspires that thinking, even without the film industry doing their thing here.
Well, I've never had the pleasure of visiting your country, but it is definitely on my bucket list.
Excellent. We love visitors.
Yes, I actually have made a few friends through my radio shows over in New Zealand, so I think it would be fascinating to come. Now, how long did it take you to write The Dragon Slayer's Son?
The Dragon Slayer's Son was one of my 6-week wonders. I knocked it out in 6 weeks. Yes, once I started, it just sort of spilled right out.
Wow. I think that's one of the shortest times I've heard for anybody composing a manuscript. Now, was that 6 weeks for the rough draft or 6 weeks to draft, edit, polish?
That was 6 weeks just for the rough draft. It took another year to get it to publication.
Okay. Whew. There was one author I had on this show who said he wrote his entire draft in 30 days and had it publication ready in another 30.
That's a little fast. I have a friend who just said he finished one just recently, a first draft, in 12 days.
Okay, living at the keyboard much?
Must be.
As much as I love books, I can't write. It's just everyone's inspired, trying to, oh, I'm surrounded by writers because I do have this huge love of books and I have my show. So I'm people are always saying, oh, you should try writing. I've tried. To me, I'd rather be beating my head against the brick wall over there than sitting here trying to type words. So
it does take discipline.
Even with that, it's just not, it brings me no joy. It feels more like a punishment to me than it is something I want to learn and craft into something to share with anybody. So I've just taken to reading instead.
That's an excellent thing to do.
Yes, I'm the person everybody writes the books for.
Yay.
Because I am absolutely a voracious reader. Although I do not keep a Goodreads account, but I have been tempted to start one on many occasions. I read on the order of 200 books a year.
That's a lot of books.
That's part of why I started the show, because I'm always running out of things to read. True little fact, my Kindle, as big as Kindle memories are, I cannot download my entire library at once. So that's a scary proposition, I think.
Mm-hmm.
So once you get your first draft done, what's your next step in the writing process? What do you do with it?
Well, I usually set it aside for a week or two to let it just to let my mind forget it, basically. And then I read through it again myself and do a round of editing. And then it goes to my family, to my husband and my kids. And we, even though the kids are teenagers now, we still read aloud every night and we do it as a family. And so I have my husband read it aloud to the whole family. And that's an incredible exercise for me because I get to actually hear how he's interpreting it, how he's interpreting my characters and the action and whatnot. And I can hear where he stumbles over maybe a sentence that isn't quite smooth enough. And I also then we have discussions every night about what we've read. And then at the end, we discuss, I get their feedback on it. And so, of course, that inspires a whole round, another round of editing. And it's only after that that anyone else gets to read it. So after I've done that round of editing of my own and that round of editing from the comments from my family, then it goes out to a team of beta readers, both kids and adults.
So
they read it and comment, and then it comes back to me for some more editing.
So what age range is your target audience for The Dragon Slayer's Son?
The Dragon Slayer's Son is really aimed at the middle grade audience, which is sort of the 8 to 13 years old range. It has my kids thought it was pretty good, and the beta readers, the kids who read it, felt it could go a little higher than that in terms of age range. But that's really who I had in mind when I wrote it.
It sounds fascinating. I mean, it sounds like a group of kids going on this incredible adventure, and I can't wait to dig into it.
It is a good adventure, and of course, I set it in New Zealand, in places that I love myself, and so, and I think, from my perspective, that shows in the writing, and you know, in the placement of the places that the kids go.
So have you visited all the places you mentioned in your book?
Not all of them, unfortunately. Some of them are very difficult to get to. Some of them are places that my characters get to on Dragonback. And I don't have the climbing skills to get there myself. So then since I don't have a real dragon to fly on, I haven't actually visited them.
Okay, but at least you've done your research, though, and you know what the place looks like, and you've seen the pictures from the people with the climbing skills.
Yes, I have. And a lot of these places, I've been to the mountain, but I haven't been to the peak where some of the action in my book happens. And so I've stood there and looked at it from below. I just haven't actually been up there.
So is one of your dreams to develop the climbing skills to actually get up to the top of that mountain?
No, unfortunately, I don't think that's really possible for me at my age. but my own children do rock climbing, and so maybe someday they'll go up there and take some photos for me.
Oh, that would probably be fantastic. Now, everyone always says, don't judge a book by its cover. But everybody does. So, did you design your own cover, or did you pay someone to design it? How did your beautiful cover come about?
I love this cover. I love the cover of this book. I work with an illustrator here in Christchurch who, he actually, most of his illustration work is for the District Health Board. He does all the illustrations for the hospital, you know, when kids come into the hospital, they have information for the kids and stuff that's kid friendly. Well, he draws all the cartoons for that. So I asked him for my, and he just does wonderful stuff. And, he really nailed the Dragon Slayer Sun cover, I thought.
It is a fantastic cover, and I love it. And I'm glad to hear you actually got someone who has that artistic background.
Because I can't draw to save my life, so there was no question that I needed someone to do my cover for me.
Oh, stick figures here.
Yep, I can't even manage stick figures most of the time.
Yep, my extent is stick figures. Thank you. I'll pass. So when you're developing these characters and coming up with the characters that are going to be in your novels, there's so much information you develop. Do your characters ever suddenly decide that they're not going to go along with whatever you had planned for them, and they just decide they're going to run off on their own little path?
All the time. I think I have a penchant for developing characters who are rebels, because they always do something crazy. Usually it's something far more interesting than I had in mind for them, so I often just run with it, but sometimes I do have to pull them back.
All right, so that being said, there's two overall categories of writers. The plotters, the ones that have these big outlines and they have every plot point picked out and they know how they're getting from plot point A to plot point B and plot point B to plot point C. And the pantsers, the ones that have no clue where it's going and they just sit down at the keyboard. And then there's this subcategory I call the hybrids. They know that plot point A is going to happen, plot point B is going to happen, but how they're getting from A to B, they don't have a clue. So where do you fall in that spectrum?
I fall somewhere in the middle as well. I generally write a detailed outline of my first few chapters before I start, and I know I have certain points along the way that I know I want to have the action go to, and I know how it's going to end. But I have a lot of leeway in between, knowing that things are going to change along the way. And so I don't bother doing anything specific, any planning specifically for anything past the first quarter of the book before I start, because I know it's going to change. So oftentimes I'll write for a while, I'll stop and I'll plot out the next few chapters. I'll write those chapters, I'll stop and I'll plot out the next few chapters, and so I sort of do a hybrid.
Now, you mentioned this was a six-week wonder, that everything just kind of poured out of you in 6 weeks. Have you mm-hmm. had that happen before?
I have, If the story has stewed in my brain for long enough, it usually just tumbles right out when I get around to writing it. And this one had been there for a while, and so I had a really good feeling.
All right, so have you had these six-week wonder books before?
I have. If a story has stewed in my head for a while, once I get around to writing it, it usually just tumbles right out, and it's mostly a matter of just recording it as it comes out of my head. Other books don't. If I haven't spent a lot of time thinking about it, it'll take longer to write.
So what's the longest it's ever taken you to write a book?
My first book, I think, took 7 years, but I wasn't writing full time at that point. I was just trying to do it at the end of the day and whatnot. And I had young children and it wasn't, you know, it wasn't really going very well. It wasn't a high priority at that point. And so it took a long time.
So do you, is that your day job, writing?
It is my day job.
Oh, I think you are blessed. I can't name the number of writers I've spoken to that have to squeeze in their writing between their day job and their family obligation.
I am incredibly lucky. I have a very supportive husband who is, yeah, just incredibly supportive and has been very accepting of the fact that I essentially bring in no money. But it's been great. It's been really good. Yeah.
So are you dispelling the myth that you can get rich quick by writing?
Anyone thinks that? No, no, you don't make any money writing. If you're doing it for the money, you're doing it for the wrong reason. When I was considering closing my business, I used to run a heritage interpretation consultancy. And when I was considering closing my business and writing full time, some writerly friends I have encouraged me not to, basically saying, unless you can't not write, don't go there. Just don't go there. Unless you must write for yourself, don't even try. And I felt that I needed to give it a go. And so I have. It's been a lot of fun.
Okay, when you say unless you must write, do you have just that desire you have to get, for lack of a term, the voices in your head out on paper?
Well, I never really considered myself a writer until I realized that I was one, if that makes sense. I realized that I wanted to do that. But I published my first poetry before I was 10 years old. So I was already writing and looking at publishing and you know, sending my work out before I could, you know, develop a complex sentence, really. So I realized, you know, when I looked back, I realized that I have always been a writer and that it was time to let that, to see what I could do with that, to see where I could go with it. So, yeah, I guess I can't not write. And I didn't, just hadn't really accepted that I was writing since I was able to hold a pencil.
When you say that if you're in it for the money, you're in it for the wrong reasons, I agree. Because other than a select tiny, tiny, tiny fraction of writers, and I'm talking like your New York Times bestseller type creatures, which they're there, but they're few and far between. You're not really going to make any significant income from writing. So I'm guessing you do it for the love of the story and the love of the craft?
I do. And I do. Two of the four books that I've written are nonfiction. And part of that, you know, part of the reason that I decided to write was because I felt I wanted to write those particular books. And there are a couple other nonfiction books that I still sort of have in the back of my head that I'd like to write as well. I'm an educator at heart, and so those books were very important to me. So some of that is for the education, some of it is for the stories and the joy of creating that, the joy of creating those worlds and those stories.
I have a note here having to do with a book about bugs.
Yes, I have a master's degree in entomology, and insects are, I probably loved insects before I loved writing, actually. And so the first book that I published is called Glint of Exoskeleton, and it is an entomological adventure with insects as some of the main characters in the book.
And what about a recent nonfiction work or one that's coming out?
I have earlier this year I published a teacher's guide called Insects in the Classroom, and it's based on my decades of teaching about insects in the school setting. And then I just a week or two ago published a kid-friendly book called Backyard Bug Watchers, and it's focused on New Zealand insects. One of the problems here in New Zealand in terms of teaching about insects is that most insect resources are written overseas, and so they're not really relevant here because our insect fauna is actually quite different. And so this guide is focused on New Zealand insects and sort of the basics around those insects and other arthropods, I should say, and focused on the basics around them and also providing some keys for folks to learn how to identify them.
Okay, arthropods.
Yes.
Define that one for me. Wait, everybody can understand it?
Animals with jointed legs and an exoskeleton, or a skeleton on the outside of their bodies. So things like spiders, centipedes, millipedes, and ticks and mites, those are all, and insects, of course, are all arthropods.
Thank you. I just always like to make sure, and I kind of fell back into the conversations and science role there that I use with Doc of, wait a minute, you just threw a big term at me. We got to get an answer.
Mm-hmm.
And do you have plans to do more books with bugs as main characters?
Potentially. I've got way more book ideas than I have time to write, even doing it full time. But yeah, I love insects and the real life facts about insects are so amazing that they really do lend themselves to fiction because they're stranger than fiction, truly. So yes, I do have some ideas for more books on bugs, but they're also in line behind a whole bunch of other ideas as well. So
what are two of your top facts about insects that people would find stranger than fiction?
Well, one of the ones that I enjoy showing kids when I do live insect programs is ladybugs, because everyone's familiar with ladybugs and everyone sort of, they're just ladybugs. But ladybugs are chemically protected, so they have in their blood, they have a very smelly, icky-tasting substance. And when they're frightened, they do what's called reflex bleeding. And that means they squeeze blood out from their knee joints. And it smells bad and it tastes bad. And so it's basically deters predators. But we can actually smell that smell. And so one of the things I do in my live insect programs is I take a couple of ladybugs in my hand and I bother them until they do this reflex bleeding, and then I let the kids smell it. And most kids have never smelled a ladybug before, and so they really like that and they think it's cool that they bleed on demand from their knees.
I think it sounds fascinating too. I don't know anything else that can bleed on demand.
No.
So with your background in insects, did you find dragons to be a natural next fantasy step, or how did you get involved with dragons?
Well, like I said, the New Zealand landscape inspires speculation, I think. We have of course, there are extinct fauna that were just spectacular here. Most people know about the moa, which were birds that could reach 2.5-3 meters in height. That's what, 12 feet. And we also had an eagle with a wingspan of 11 feet, the Haast eagle. There are Maori legends of it carrying off people, children, which it certainly could have done. So we have some really spectacular wildlife that you think when you go into an area like Fiordland, which is very remote, you think, my God, these creatures could still exist here because there's so much space and people don't come here. And, you know, maybe what if they're here? So it's easy to sort of imagine, well, gosh, what if there were dragons here too? And it's interesting because, of course, New Zealand wildlife has so many unique adaptations for life here on this island in the middle of the ocean. And so you think, well, if dragons were here, they would have some interesting adaptations that maybe dragons other places in the world wouldn't have. And so for me, as someone who likes biology and who gets into the natural world, it was a fascinating exercise to imagine what New Zealand dragons would be like if there were New Zealand dragons.
So are your dragons the typical fire-breathing, crazy monsters that we see in many fantasy books?
Well, that would be giving it away, wouldn't it?
Do they breathe fire?
Yes, they do.
Okay.
Yes, they do.
That's not giving too much away. A fire-breathing dragon.
No, it's not.
But I do think it's going to be a fascinating read because these kids, they go on, it sounds like they just go on this epic adventure, and it sounds like Murphy's Law fame of what can go wrong will happens to them.
Yes.
Now, what kind of growth process do your characters go through on the emotional level?
Well, every one of my characters has lost a parent, at least one parent, because the school that trains dragon slayers, you only get trained once your dragon slayer parent dies. So they're all going through that process of grief. So there are things surrounding that they're going through, that they're working through. They've just been pulled away from, not only have they lost a parent, but they're in this school that they've just been sort of whisked away to, with new people and making new friends, dealing with friendships, dealing with people who aren't very nice, who aren't dealing well with their own, you know, parents' death. So there's bullying and stuff like that. So they're dealing with all the sort of early teen crap that people deal with, as well as being in this setting where they're learning all these amazing things.
So do your characters change over the course of the book? I mean, obviously they're still teenagers at the end, right?
Yeah, absolutely. The book only spans a couple of months of time, but they do change. Because they are going on this adventure alone, for kids alone, you know, without any adults, you know, they're learning to do things for themselves. They're learning to think for themselves. They're learning to work together. They're sort of taking responsibility that they had never had to take before. So they're growing in that way. They're really sort of learning who they are and what they stand for.
I've got to ask, are there both boy and girl dragon slayers?
Yes. Well, that's sort of interesting because it's a change in sort of this system that is in place in the Dragon Slayer's Son. It used to be only men who were dragon slayers, but as family sizes grew smaller, they started to have to take on the girls as well, because there weren't enough boys to replace their parents. Because, as you can imagine, the mortality rate in the dragon slaying profession is rather high. So they started taking on girls, but it's a relatively recent thing. So in the Dragon Slayer's Son, there are only two girls at the school for dragon slayers, but they are two of the four who go on this adventure, and they are. They're very strong personalities, the two girls.
I think it's great that you included a couple of strong female characters. I really do.
That was really important to me. In fact, I hesitated having the main character be a boy. it ended up working out that way, and that was fine. But I definitely wanted to have those strong girls in there, and they are the four of them would not survive their adventure without the girls. So they pull their weight and then some.
Now, like the mythological world of Hogwarts and the real New Zealand schools, does this school have the houses where your houses become like your family, and there's the collective gain and collective loss of different rewards and things like that?
No, I this isn't a Harry Potter book. there's no magic. The dragons are biological creatures. They're not magical creatures. There's no magic in this book. The school is very small. Of course, there's not a huge call for a lot of dragon slayers, and so the school is actually quite small. There's only about 25, 26 kids in the school, and they're divided in their classwork. They're divided into sort of 6-month blocks. So there's the kids who have been at the school for under 6 months, those who have been there 6 to 12 months, and then 12 to 18, and 18 to 24, because it's a 2-year program. So in a sense, they're divided by class, just because that's how they have their studies, but there's not really houses or anything.
Okay. I just, knowing just a little bit about the New Zealand society, I was just wondering if that little fact had carried over, but given a school of that size, I can see where there wouldn't be room for such thing.
No.
So what was your favorite part of the book that you had to take out? There's always something you want to leave in, but editing is called slaying your darlings for a reason.
And when I first wrote it, I had a lovely little story told by one of the old dragon slayers who now works at the school. And it was a great tale, sort of told in the like a fisherman, a big fish that got away sort of tale. But it didn't advance the plot. And so eventually it had to come out.
May I ask what became of that story? I'm sure you didn't discard those beautiful words.
It still sits there. It will probably show up again somewhere. It may end up showing up in the next of the Dragon Slayer books, told in a slightly different way at a different event. but it has some relevance to the plot of the next book in the series, and so it may show up there.
So you're already working on the next book in the series?
The next book in the series is about maybe 2/3 written, the first draft, yes.
Oh, outstanding. So that means you'll be back on the coffee shop in what, about a year?
Well, I hope, yes.
Well, whether
and
that's...
the second book is called The Dragon Slayer's Daughter, and it's written from the viewpoint of one of the female characters in the first book. One of the four kids who go on that adventure. We're still with those four kids, but this one is written from the perspective of one of the girls.
Oh, I think that sounds fascinating. And also, whether that's a year, 18 months, or 2 years, I expect you back in the coffee shop.
That sounds great.
All right, we are going to take a commercial break because, yes, it's time to pay those radio station bills. And we'll be back with you on the other side.
Most writers and radio show hosts know that to connect with your fans, you need to do more than just write books or record the latest podcasts. There are many different elements that go into forming an online platform, but there are also many hidden traps. To make matters worse, solid advice on how to survive the muddy waters is scarce. In the book Hidden Traps, I talk about some of the important issues of working with an online platform, highlighting traps that could put your physical or internet security at risk, or be harmful to your reputation. Are your social media posts just links with a few disjointed words making you look like someone who can't complete a sentence? Did your new website cost you more than you anticipated? Are you leaking your personal contact details across the web without even knowing it? Then you need Hidden Traps. Hidden Traps is now available in paperback and ebook from a variety of retailers, including Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and Kobo. Visit blackwolfpublications.com for more details.
If you're 85 or younger, would you like peace of mind and comfort for your family? We're Final Expense Direct with an urgent message for you. The average funeral today costs over $8,000, but the most you'll get from government benefits is $255. How will your family pay the difference? We can help. Our senior plans start as low as just a dollar a day and pay up to $30,000 for a funeral and other final expenses. Peace of mind is easy. There's no medical exam. You'll have lifetime coverage, and your plan can't be canceled as long as you pay your premiums. Call now for free information about our senior plans. Answer a few simple questions and receive approval right on the phone. Plus, call right now, and we'll give you a discount prescription card for free. Call 800-553-8687. That's 800-553-8687. Again, 800-553-8687.
KLRN Radio has advertising rates available. We have rates to fit almost any budget. Contact us at advertising@klrnradio.com.
Everyone loves liberty. Our rights come from God, not the government. So why are you letting other people tell you what's best for your health care? Exercise your freedom with Liberty HealthShare. Liberty HealthShare is a community of people who voluntarily share one another's medical costs. Liberty HealthShare is founded on the idea that most people truly want to help one another. Healthcare sharing allows members to do just that as a true community that supports one another in times of need. Liberty believes people should make decisions for themselves and their families. Members are able to take back the freedom to make their own decisions about their health care. Freedom from guilt or doubt about how your money is used. You have the freedom to direct your health care, not to be dictated to by bureaucrats. Stop letting others tell you what to do and join a community of like-minded people. Exercise your freedom. Join Liberty HealthShare and take back the control of your health care while helping those around you. Call Liberty at 855-58-LIBERTY. Again, that's 855-58-LIBERTY for more information, or you can check them out at libertyhealthshare.org. Again, that's libertyhealthshare.org.
Sometimes riders feel lost, unsure why a passage may not be working. It takes another set of eyes to help us nurture our riding into full maturity. At Black Wolf Editorial Services, we strive to enable riders to develop and grow, offering manuscript critiques and line edits through a mentoring editorial style. We also offer assistance on generating a rider's bio for your websites. Black Wolf Editorial Services, nurturing your riding into maturity. For a full list of services, visit blackwolfeditorial.com.
And I thank all of y'all for hanging in there with us while we paid those radio station bills. And yes, my guest Robin Weiss is still with us. So Robin, are you self-published or traditionally published?
I have self-published my books.
Okay, that is a very common in this day and age path. What made you choose self-publish over traditional publish?
Well, my original thought when I started seriously writing was, you know, I wanted to get a traditional publishing contract. But the landscape is changing so rapidly in publishing. And as I learned more and as I watched things changing in the publishing industry, I realized that that traditional contract wasn't going to give me a lot of value, frankly. That you know, there were a lot of middlemen to pay and middlemen who maybe didn't provide a lot for me. And so the more I thought about it and the more I realized, hey, I'd like to try this. I'd like to try self-publishing. It gives me more control over the whole process, which I appreciate. It works well with my personality. And it also lets me just move ahead and make something happen. It was bothersome to me to have to send out manuscripts to publishers and agents and then wait for months and months and months at a time and not be doing anything, that it was in somebody else's hands. So it works with my personality.
Well, as I like to say, self-published, traditional publish, hybrid, you're all welcome in the coffee shop. But I think you're right. There isn't the stigma attached with self-publishing that there used to be. It's becoming more and more common and less controversial.
Yeah, and I had to overcome a lot of my own prejudices about self-publishing because I had read a number of self-published books that I felt were poorly edited and poorly written, and just I felt like, gosh, do I want to be in that crowd? But it has changed, and just in the standards of the quality standards of self-published books and traditionally published books have really converged. So you can't necessarily tell the difference between a well-published self-published book and a traditionally published book anymore.
Well, that brings me to one of the next things I always like to do with all my authors on Coffee Shop. What advice would you give to a beginning writer?
Spend most of your time writing. Don't worry about all the other stuff. Don't worry about whether it's going to be published or how it's going to be published. Just write and work on that craft first. Because if you don't have that, then that's the base. So work on your craft first.
Goes back to the old saying, you can't edit a blank page?
Exactly.
All right, you write a very fascinating genre, fantasy. How do you research a fantasy world?
Well, all fantasy is based on reality. And if the reality of your fantasy doesn't make sense, then your reader's not going to be interested in it. So, like, for example, my dragons, they're dragons, they're mythical creatures. But I developed them thinking about the natural history and ecology of animals living in New Zealand, animals that are native to New Zealand. And so, you know, they're all based on real ecology, real biology, so that they're believable. And so I do, you know, you do a lot of research in that realm. I'm trying to make sure that, you know, even in the fantasy world, there are rules of physics and biology and chemistry and all that other stuff that you have to abide by. And if you don't understand those rules and abide by them, then your fantasy is not believable.
I have to say that that is one of the things that makes the difference between a good book and it's a book. Because when I'm reading, if something just doesn't make sense, I'm going to use a physical example. It would be like putting Christchurch, New Zealand, suddenly in Sydney, Australia, and putting the Sydney Opera House in the middle of downtown Christchurch. Unless you can back it up with a valid plot point of why these two places swap, it's going to jar me out of the book and make me want to put your book down.
Absolutely. I'm very sort of being in tune with the natural world and having been trained in a biological field, I'm very sensitive to things like, are your moon phases right? You know, is the full moon rising in the middle of the night when it shouldn't be? Is a crescent moon rising as the sun sets, which it shouldn't be? Are certain flowers blooming at the wrong time of year? Are certain things happening when they shouldn't happen? I'm very sensitive to that stuff. And I try to be very careful to get that stuff right in my own books.
I think it's the details, the little tiny details, like you said, like the right flower blooming at the right season, that actually make a novel better. Because it means that I can actually take your book, find that flower, assuming it's a real flower, look it up on Google and go, yeah, that flower would bloom in that month of the year.
Absolutely. And even when I've written a couple stories that are in fantasy worlds, you know, that aren't on Earth or aren't, you know, on Earth as we know it today. And even within a totally made up world, you have to have some internal consistency. You have to have a system for, you know, how do the seasons run? What is the climate like? And make sure you stick to that, because random things happening at random times doesn't work in a story. And so you've got to have that world built well enough to have it make sense and have it be coherent, so somebody can feel that they're that, you know, just like we know that spring follows winter, you know, people can understand the world that you've plunked them into in the book, and so that it makes sense to them.
So how do you go about crafting your fantasy world?
A lot of it will depend upon the plot. Like, if I'm doing a complete fantasy world, I'll spend a fair bit of time coming up with the world and not just the physical world, but also the cultures that are within the human cultures and other cultures, if I have other cultures in the world, political systems and all the stuff that goes up to making a world. But then I'll always forget things. I'll always realize halfway through the book, then halfway through the plot, that, oh my gosh, I have no idea how this one thing works in this world. And then I'll have to go back and I'll have to, you know, work that out and figure out how that fits within this world that I've created already. And sometimes that means going way back in the writing as well and fixing a lot of things that don't make sense now. So it's an iterative process.
Well, I think as long as the person has a world that makes sense to the characters in it, it makes a much better book. Like I said, you just don't want to move things around and have random things crop up and random things happen. Or the way I put it, you jar your reader out of the story. And yes, they can suspend disbelief long enough to believe that dragons are real. But if you suddenly have a character who, in a world that doesn't have immortality, who is immortal and can't be killed, it's just not going to fit.
Definitely, you have to have that internal consistency to your world.
So when you're not writing about dragons and bugs, what are you doing?
We live on what here is called a lifestyle property. It's we have some land, a little farmlet. And so I raise most of the family's food in one shape or another. I grow most of all our vegetables and do a little milk and cheese as well. And so I spend a lot of time on that.
I think that sounds fascinating. It really does.
It keeps me busy. Keeps me off the streets. Out of trouble.
Oh, definitely would keep me busy. So I've always heard this said, I just think it's true in the fantasy genre as well as everything else. As a writer, you have to know, the book is like an iceberg. You, as the writer, have to know the entire iceberg from top to bottom. Even if the reader only gets to see that top 10% that's peeking out of the water. And are there things you wish you could tell your readers about the world, but they just don't fit into your plot? Or do you manage to work in most of the things you want your readers to know?
Well, I try and work in everything the reader needs to know. But what they need to know is a lot, as you say, a lot less than what I know about the world. And there are times when I very specifically leave some things out. There are certain things in the Dragons, or not in the Dragon Slayer's Son, that hopefully will make readers say, well, what about this? And I'm hoping to do that, you know, hoping that they're having those questions, because they're going to learn more about that in the next book.
So you like to leave a few threads hanging for your next book?
Well, certainly enough questions that the readers would like to know more, that they haven't gotten all the information. There are gaps in this world that they would like filling in. And hopefully they're not gaps that leave them saying, well, huh, this doesn't work. But they're gaps that are like, wow, I wonder about that.
I think that's a great way to encourage someone to continue reading with us here. When you can develop that curiosity about this unknown world that just draws you in.
Definitely.
Is that a hard thing for you to learn to write into a book?
Oh, I think so. Because I think, you want, especially when you're getting feedback from your beta readers, they're pointing out these gaps. And part of you is like, oh, well, I want to satisfy my readers. And if this isn't satisfying them, maybe I should put that in. But there's a certain point where you have to step back and say, well, actually, I want them to have those questions, and it's okay.
I think that is a fascinating tale of balancing act. And it makes because I know with me, I'll start researching a news story for my other radio show, and I will get caught up chasing this one little fact around the globe on the internet. And sometimes I get the answer I'm seeking, and other times it's like, I want to know more about that. So I'll start picking up the phone, making phone calls, or doing whatever it takes to get that information. And in this case, it would be buy the next book.
Mm-hmm.
So do you ever struggle with leaving in and taking out, or how, did you ever struggle with that art of leaving just enough gaps to make them hungry for more?
Oh, absolutely. I think with every story you do, because again, with every story, you know more than what you can put in the story. And so it's always a question of, well, what do I leave out and what's really critical? To be honest, I think, a lot of my previous career actually helps with that, because I did a lot of heritage interpretation writing, which is, the signage that you see in national parks and whatnot that tells you about a certain feature or whatever. That's heritage interpretation. And I was doing a lot of writing for panels and whatnot here in New Zealand. And there on a panel, you have at most 225 words. And so how do you take, say, the geologic history of New Zealand and reduce it to 225 words? And so that's a skill that you learn by doing over and over and over again. And though I was doing that in the nonfiction world for many decades, it actually spills over into the fiction world as well. I have this vast knowledge of my own worlds that I'm building. What pieces are the most important to put into my story? What pieces are critical?
That actually goes back to a tip that aired on Coffee Shop way back in one of my early episodes. We were discussing editing, and somebody suggested trying to summarize your scene in a tweet to figure out what the actual key points in that scene were, because you only get 140 characters.
Yep, and I do... I use some of the techniques that I use in nonfiction. I also use in my fiction as well. One of the things in interpretation, in heritage interpretation, that we talk about is this idea of a theme. And a theme is the take-home message. What is the one absolutely critical thing that your reader or visitor or whatever that you want them to go home with? What's that key take-home message? And I create themes for my books. My stories, I'll create a theme for a chapter or whatever. And it's purely for my own use, so that I know what my end goal is, and so that I can craft that piece of writing to meet that end goal.
All right. Well, is there anything that we haven't touched on that you wanted to bring up?
I don't think so. It's been nice to talk to you, and I hope that your listeners enjoy, if they choose to have a look at my books. I hope they enjoy them. And I'm looking forward to putting out some more books, both this year and later on in the years to come.
Well, at this point, as I do with every guest, I always give my guests a chance to give out their social media contact information.
Excellent. So I am, my website is robinweiss.com, RobinneWeiss.com. And from that website, you can visit my blog. You can check out my books and get links to all that good information on how to get them and whatnot. You can read all about me.
Well, I thank you very much for joining me in the coffee shop today, Robin. And for those of you wanting to catch up with me, you can find me on Twitter at Jesse's POV, or you can drop me an email at the station, Jesse, J-E-S-S-I-E, @klrnradio.com. and I think it is time for me to pour myself a cup of coffee and settle in with the Dragon Slayer's son. And I will see you folks on the next episode of The Coffee Shop.